Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with alto saxophonist and composer Will Vinson. Originally from London and now in New York City, he started out on the piano and finally found his instrument in the saxophone. He talked about quite a few things during a bit of time with Neon Jazz after spending months on the road. He discussed the countries he has visited, playing with musicians like Rufus Wainwright and Sean Lennon, along with the gig he would like to see if he could get into that jazz time machine, along with much, much more. Dig it, my friend.
Let me just dive in here and get an idea of what has been going on with you lately.
Well, let's see. In reverse order, I just got back from, I don't know, like two and a half months on the road, pretty much, with a couple of gaps. But most recently, I was doing some gigs in my sort of moonlighting role as pianist for my wife, who's a great singer. We do some gigs together sometimes with me playing piano. So we were doing some gigs in Europe like that. And immediately before that, I do an occasional I'm kind of an adjunct professor at the Royal Academy of Music in London. So I did like a week there working with the students. And before that, I was on the road for 2 weeks in Europe with my band, with Mike Moreno, Clarence Penn, and Rick Rosato. And before that, I was in Japan with Gonzalo Rubalcaba, because he has a CD coming out that I play on, which is a tribute to Charlie Hayden. We play all Charlie's music. Cool. And before that, I was on the road with Jonathan Kreisberg for about 3 weeks. And before that, it was Christmas.
Yeah.
I've been busy this year. Oh yeah, and actually the thing I forgot to mention in there was that in February, I think it was in February, January. Anyway, I recorded my new record, which I'm going to be finishing up this summer, which is for Gonzalo's label, which is called Five Passion. And Gonzalo is on it, Mike Moreno, Matt Penman, and Jeff Ballard. So
wonderful.
I'm looking forward to getting stuck into sort of mixing and editing and all that stuff this summer.
Right on. So let's go back a little bit further. And you grew up in London.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get an idea of what your environment was like where you grew up that fostered your love of jazz.
I grew up listening to my dad's records, which I guess until about the age of 10 or so, I was not interested in at all. And something clicked, and it was Count Basie. Count Basie was my introduction to jazz. And then that was immediately sort of snowballed into, you know, Ben Webster, Lester Young, Duke Ellington. My dad was also an Oscar Peterson fan. My dad's a pianist, not a professional pianist, but he plays the piano a lot. I got into that world, kind of wasn't really checking out bebop so much. Like I was kind of in an earlier era than that for the most part. And then I began taking jazz piano lessons with a inspirational guy who's now he's now about 90, but he's still around, still teaching, I think, whose name was Leon Cohen. And this is in London. And I took lessons with him, and he got me interested in, I mean, I don't know whether, I don't think he was really shepherding me this way, but he introduced me to a lot more recent music, notably like Chick Corea, Weather Report, and so I went from being into kind of like big band swing era music straight into like 70s fusion, and it took me a while to sort of dial back and fill in the gaps, and I think, you know, that kind of idiosyncratic introduction to the music was partly because, although I had, you know, I had my dad's records as an influence, and although I had Leon, beyond that, there wasn't much of a community that I was part of like that. I wasn't really playing with people. Like, in my school, there were, you know, nobody else was really interested in jazz, and those that were, you know, couldn't really play. So it was, sorry, I've got somebody's texting me like crazy here, but hopefully that'll stop.
It's okay.
And yeah, so that's kind of how it happened. And I didn't really play with anyone when I was in London. I was a very shy teenager, and I didn't know how to get into any kind of network of playing. I would go to Ronnie Scott's, which is a great club in London. And I would go and check out music all the time, but I wasn't really playing with people really until I came to New York. So that was a rapid education that happened once I got here.
Yeah, absolutely. So you started out on the piano when you were younger. Why did you levitate and decide that the saxophone was your instrument?
Levitate, I like that. I started on the piano, and then I had a classical piano teacher who I didn't really connect with very well, let's say, and but I was still, I knew I was interested in music, and I was getting interested in jazz, so my parents rented me a saxophone, and I started to take some lessons. But I wasn't really taking anything terribly seriously at that point until I met Leon, the jazz piano teacher, and that's when I really started to become serious about playing, and of course that was piano related. But then, you know, I found that, you know, most of what I was studying in jazz wasn't really necessarily instrument specific. You know, I mean, you know, when you're learning about improvising and about harmony and rhythm and all the rest of it, it's like, you know, that can be done on any instrument. So I was kind of going back and forth, and I didn't really make a decision until I was in my late teens. And to be honest, it was a very practical decision. It was just, I actually started to get some form of tendonitis back then, which affected me when I played the piano, but not when I played the saxophone. So that was basically it. That was what made the decision for me. I eventually managed to take care of that particular problem. But by that point, I was a saxophone player. That's how I remember it happening. I'm not sure whether that's actually true or not. Maybe
yeah.
Maybe it had already happened. I don't know. But well, I was on the fence for a long time.
Yeah. So kind of on the topic of momentous change in your life, you go from London to New York City. What kind of culture shock? What kind of residuals went through your life after you made that move?
Well, I have to say, it's not that much of a culture shock. I think if you were coming from somewhere in the States, you know, there's a lot of people who come here from other places in the States probably go through a bigger culture shock than I did, because London is a city of a comparable size, and, you know, it's got a lot of the same challenges. You know, it's like there's things about it that make it a nightmare and things that make it very exciting. And so culturally, there wasn't a big issue. Musically, it was intense, because I came from a place that obviously likes to think, and, you know, with good reason, that it has a great music scene, and specifically a good jazz scene. You know, and there are a lot of great players in London, but New York is just a completely different place from anywhere on the planet when it comes to just the level of, you know, the jazz scene is both broad and deep. You know, like the level of musicality is incredible, but it's also really widespread. It's not just that the musicians are so good, it's that there's so many musicians that are so good. You know, it's that was the thing that just really blew me away. I mean, you can just get lost. You know, like you when you come to New York, you are nobody.
Yeah.
And you know, you might be able to, you know, if you can play, you'll be able to impress a few people here and there. But like, to actually finding your way into a scene is like, it's something that takes a long time, and also it requires a lot of changes and improvements from you, because, you know, everybody has these weaknesses that in smaller scenes can go unaddressed. you know, because there isn't as much intense kind of there aren't as many intense examples of like how to do what you're doing wrong right. You know what I mean? Whereas in New York, it's just so much is expected of you from the get go. So for you to, you know, you really have to get your shit together, basically. Yeah. And I remember reading a Joe Henderson interview when I was still in London, like a few years before I came to New York. And he was saying, you know, you need to get your shit together before you come to New York, but and then come to New York. Don't go to New York to get yourself together. So, but I think, like, no matter how much stuff you have together, you come to New York and you realize immediately everything that remains, you know, for you to work on, just to like be able to poke your head over the, you know, to keep your head above water. I mean, it's crazy. So there was that, and you know, and that was very overwhelming. And I was in school. I came here to go to school. I'm obviously not an American citizen, and so you know, you need to get a visa, and going to school is the easiest way to do that. And back then, it wasn't as expensive as it is now. So I was able to do that, and you know, even just in the school environment, it was intimidating. Never mind when you actually venture out and go to jam sessions and stuff like that. So there was I had a lot to learn, but it was great. I mean, it was amazing having that kind of stimulus. I've long been aware that I can work really hard, but I kind of need external motivators to get me to do so. You know, if you start, some people, you know, will grow up in a cornfield and learn to be an amazing musician. I know a lot of people who basically did that. You know, I know there's a lot of great musicians from Iowa, for example. Yeah. But I couldn't. I mean, that's not the way I'm wired. You know, I need to be surrounded by people who are better than me, so I can be inspired. And New York is, you know, if it doesn't kill you, it will make you stronger.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So,
but it can kill you.
Yeah, it can. It can. New York's been known to. As a kid, did you always dream about getting into music, or was there something else?
No, there's nothing else.
Yeah.
My mother thought that I would make a good lawyer because I can be very annoyingly nitpicky and pedantic, but that was never really an interest. I always wanted to be a musician.
Right on. So, you've shared the stage with a lot of people over the years. You've shared the stage with a lot of legends and luminaries. And, you know, as you say, you surround yourself around people that play better than you or at your level. What is it like when you share the stage with greatness, with these cats that you've shared the stage with over the years?
Well, it's a way of, I mean, first of all, it's an amazing honor. And I have played with some, you know, some people who certainly to me are legends, and but you know, there's a lot more people on that list that I would like to play with, but it's, you know, it feels you know, I feel the privilege and everything, but it also it's just really reinvigorating. Like, it reminds me of why I'm playing music. I mean, I don't really ever forget that, but sometimes, you know, if you're kind of doing the same thing a lot, maybe something that you're very used to, and you're not, you know, maybe if, like, again, for me, if the music, if I'm playing a lot of my own music and it's all coming from within me, sometimes, you know, there are sort of some aspects of what gets me into music in the first place, the external stimuli that I'm sort of missing. And when I play with somebody who's playing their music, and it's always different playing somebody else's music with them.
Yeah.
And it's always different playing your music with a new person if they bring something really special to it. It's it just completely reinvigorates everything. It's like I'm playing music for the first time in a way, you know, at its best. So I've had some experiences playing with people like that, where it's just like, wow, I'm playing with somebody who's playing on this really high level, and they're lifting me to another level, that they're bringing something out of me that I didn't know I could do.
Yeah.
And that is a really profound experience. And not to mention, I mean, there are some people, I was just playing with Gonzalo in Japan, and just standing next to the piano while he's playing it is like, I forget even playing. I don't even need to play. So I just stand there and listen to him. You really being up close with that kind of genius, you know, it's really an inspiring moment. And then to feel yourself be part of it is incredible too. So that's what it feels like.
Yeah. So being next to that greatness, that genius, you've talked about some of your teachers throughout your life. Who has taught you the most about music?
I think I have to say that it's Leon, you know, this guy in London that is not a, he's an excellent pianist, but he's not a famous pianist. And he's certainly somebody that, most people won't have heard of, but he taught me a lot about, you know, stuff that, you know, early on I needed to learn about theory and harmony and a little bit about technique and stuff like that. But really what was most inspiring about him was just his incredible, like, voracious appetite for music and for the ability to be excited about hearing things that you haven't heard before and learning from them, and just his sort of exuberance in that sense was really inspiring. And that remains today. Like, he's in his late 80s, and I saw him just a few weeks ago, and he's really excited because he's just heard something that's changed his entire perspective on music. That kind of personality was really powerful for me. I also learned a lot from Tim Garland. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Yeah.
Lately he's become known for playing with Chick Corea. But he was, you know, he lived not far from me, and he was one of my early saxophone teachers. And he taught me a lot about, improvising in a modern context and playing original music and stuff like that. And, another North London saxophone player who has a career outside of that. Not that many of them do, but a guy called Jim Tomlinson, who is married to Stacey Kent, who's a great jazz singer. He got me really into Stan Getz and Lester Young, and really, opened my ears to those sounds, which I guess I wasn't listening to otherwise. And which have become, especially Stan, I mean, it's, you know, kind of one of my heroes. And then Dick Oates, who I studied with at Manhattan School, who just, you know, I mean, it's hard to put my finger on what he taught me, because it was as much about the experience of hanging with them as it was, you know, about anything specific. You know, I mean, he taught me a lot about kind of chilling out and not having anything to prove on the instrument, which, you know, when you're a young saxophone player in New York and there's a billion other young saxophone players around, it's really hard not to always feel like you have something to prove when you're playing.
Yeah.
You know? But it's when you do, it's when you're in that mindset that actually you produce the least valuable music, you know?
Absolutely.
So he taught me a lot about that. Not that I really learned the lesson that well, but yeah.
So going from actually playing with people and teaching, let's kind of get into geography a little bit. You've been all over the world. You played music everywhere from, you know, Portugal, Italy, Denmark, Japan. What country really blew you away with their appreciation for jazz? It was just like, whoa, I just didn't expect this.
Well, I got to say, my favorite places to play are Japan and France. Because in France, they still have record stores in France that sell jazz records. I mean, there's not many places in the world you can say that about. And people, like young people in France, know about jazz. I mean, it's not all of them, obviously, but there's a real, like, it's, they've really embraced the music as listeners and as fans in a way that transcends the music community itself. You know, like a lot of other places in the world, people who are interested in the music are musicians. But in France, I mean, they really, there's like, I don't know, there's like a festival for every day of the year in France that yeah. You know, that has jazz. And of course, you know, when you're there, you get treated very well, and the food and the wine is fantastic. So I spent a lot of time there, and I really like being there. I love playing in Japan. The care and the treatment that you receive is really great. And the audiences are, it's interesting. I mean, there's a general sort of trend in Europe, at least, and in America, in the continent of America, the amount of love that you get from the audience is directly proportional to the latitude of geographically. You know, in the northern reaches, the audiences, although they really appreciate you, they don't show it as much. They're very restrained. They clap quietly and they don't make a lot of noise. And as you can, we move gradually down to warmer climates, people make a lot more noise and they're much more appreciative. Often the money is not as good. It's like there's an inverse proportionality there. So it's kind of interesting. But, you know, playing in Scandinavia and Finland especially, where I've played a lot, the audiences are very quiet. And sometimes you feel that you feel like they hate it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's actually kind of difficult. But then they come up to you afterwards and they're like, that was the most amazing thing I've heard in my life. And they're like, oh, God, I wish I'd known that at the time.
Yeah.
But then you play in Italy and in the south of France and in Spain, people, you know, they react to you like you're a rock star. You know, it's really beautiful thing. So, I have to admit that the playing experience is more fun in those situations.
Yeah.
And I played a little bit in Colombia and in Brazil and in Ecuador, and same sort of thing down there, like really warm audiences. And actually, when I've played, which I haven't done very much, but when I played in the southern states of the U.S., same thing.
Yeah.
You know, in Texas, in Mississippi, in Louisiana, you know, like great audiences, really fun, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, my background is I'm from England, I'm from the north. And so, you know, I'm used to the restrained vibe. So when I get the really warm vibe, it really means a lot. You know, I really enjoy it.
Yeah.
So, I'd say 75% of my playing is in Europe. Yeah. 20% of it is probably in the States, and then another 5% other places in the world. I'd really like to play more in South America and in Asia.
Yeah.
And in Africa, you know, I mean, I've played a very small amount in Africa, and I'd love to play there more, but, you know, it's not always that easy.
Yeah, sure.
But hopefully one of these days.
So not only in jazz have you gotten around quite a bit, you played with Rufus Wainwright, Beth Orton, Sean Lennon, a lot of big, huge names in the world of pop rock music. What is it like to not only get involved with kind of a different vibe that they have, but these are very accomplished musicians in their own right? What's it like to tour and be with them and kind of deviate a little from that jazz vibe?
It's great. I mean, it's, you know, the thing about jazz is like any kind of, I sort of don't really want to use the word niche because it seems a little bit belittling, but you know, jazz is not a niche. It's much bigger and more important than that. But in a way, you know, it's kind of a niche interest. And when you're in the company all the time of musicians who are interested in the same things you are, you get very kind of, well, this doesn't necessarily happen, but often the kind of the blinkers go on a little bit and you forget a bit about what, you know, what's going on, what the rest of the world is interested in.
Yeah.
And you get this, you get into this kind of purist mentality, or you can. And so being in a world where you don't have to worry, you can let all of that go and just enjoy entertaining people, is really fun. I mean, I haven't done it for a while, but I love being in that world. You know, it's like it's a completely different set of musical values and much less hang-ups, you know.
Yeah.
So it's really enjoyable. Of course, on the you know, the other side of the coin is that, you know, musically you don't have as much freedom and it's hard to reach any of the real like musical highs that you can when you're really, you know, when you're in a band that's improvising and listening to each other and doing something new every night. You know, you it's hard to reach those levels when you're playing pop music. But you know, there's something to be said for playing to really large numbers of people, which is really satisfying. So, ideally, my career will continue to have a bit of both of those things going on, because I get bored if I'm doing the same thing.
Sure.
Anyway, I mean, I love playing. I love touring with my band. I like writing music. I love playing my music with other people and seeing what they do with it. But I, you know, like after a few weeks on the road playing my music every night, I just want to do anything else.
Yeah, right.
And it's the same doing, you know, playing somebody else's music or playing pop music or whatever.
Sure. Let me ask you this. Being around as much as you have and, you know, having such a bead on music as you do, if you could go into a time machine and go anywhere and see any show, it could be jazz or otherwise, what show would you want to see?
Well, that's a good one. Well, I have to say, like, you know, the thing that it's a little bit obvious, I suppose, but the bell that's really clanging out in my mind now is I would love to have seen Monk and Coltrane together.
Yeah.
You know, or even just Monk or just Coltrane, but pitching myself at the last and checking that out back in the day. Yeah, I think it would be Monk and Coltrane.
Right on.
But absolutely.
Let me ask you this. What's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
Well, I have a new coffee machine, so... that's a good question. I presume you mean as a musician. Well... not knowing what the next musical experience I have is going to be like.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice. It does get, like I say, you know, that monotony gets on my nerves. So
sure.
Like, you know, and anytime I've got something coming up that's something that I haven't done before.
Yeah.
That keeps me going.
The newness, yeah. Let me ask you this. Why do you love jazz so much?
That's a question that the answer to it is kind of a given for most of us. So I think we don't really think about that much about how we would answer it. For me, it's what I love about it is, I mean, I love that it exists, what I'm doing is, I don't want to say a continuation because I don't want to be self-important. I love that I'm part of some minuscule part of one of the greatest and relatively youngest traditions of art on the planet, and I love the fact that I love watching it change and stay the same and grow I love the sense of communion that comes with playing with like-minded musicians or even unlike-minded musicians within the context of jazz. I love the broadness of it and also like the minutiae of it. I love the the minuscule differences in the interpretation of time and harmony. I love the real time the real time manifestation of how people's ears work, you know.
Yeah.
Hearing that happen and then in a way that it'll never happen again.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Absolutely. So my final question here is going to kind of put you in a position where you have to use brevity and that good old-fashioned impromptu. I want you to tell me, who are you, and the length, give or take, a little bit of a tweet.
In the length of a tweet?
Yeah. Who are you?
Oh, wow.
And the other way that I phrase this sometimes is this. If someone goes to see you live and you blow their doors down, they're like, man, I need to check Will out. I want to see what his story is. They Google your name and boom, there is a description of who you are. They really don't know who you are. They know your music. But if someone was to say, who is Will Benson? And from you and your perspective and brevity, who are you?
Damn. That's a really tough one. Okay. Let me just think about all the things that I am. I think I would say with absolute brevity, I don't know what I would say other than saxophone player and music lover.
That's perfect. Hey, Will, thanks for opening up and giving me some of your time today. I really appreciate it.
Not at all. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York, Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Will Vincent for his time, cool, and music. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store, or you can visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.